Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
So the whole reason that I almost didn't record a podcast on Sing Street was because I don't think anyone has seen Sing Street. Not that I want to invalidate the people in the Real World Theology Facebook group, but outside of our small community of people in that group, I have heard zero people talking about this movie, which is very sad. And on top of that, when I tell people, or when people have asked, hey, what are you doing tonight, Mikey? Or, hey, what you got going on this week? And I'm like, oh, I'm recording another podcast. And they're like, oh, what's it on? Usually I'm saying something, and I don't know why they say it like that, but I say some movie, and they're like, oh, yeah, you've seen that already? And I'm like, oh, yeah, it's great. Or they're like, oh, man, I saw that. It was so good. Are you going to talk about X, Y, or Z? And I'm like, yes, I am. It's going to be awesome. But they're like, did you just make that up? Sing Street? Is this like an old film? You know, like, is this like one of those 1950s films? Because it has kind of like that name title kind of to it. It's like Singing in the Rain, Sing Street, you know, Sound of Music, whatever. So, you know, it has that older kind of title. So just no, I feel like no one has heard of it. And that's kind of a bummer because I think it's a pretty great film. Right now, I don't know if it's in my top five, but it's definitely, it would make my best of the year list as of now, given we've all seen just the movies coming out on Christmas Day alone, much less the movies coming like the week before and after Christmas. We have a very, very packed award season, but outside of that, Sing Street is really good. Mm. And so I'm kind of curious, like, how did you even hear about it, Josh?
Yeah, just as a side note, I'd be super surprised if this doesn't get a little bit of recognition at the Oscars, at least for original music or something, you know. But and then maybe some more people see it. But the only reason I saw it is, I mean, this is going to be kind of a roundabout, you know, kind of hand clapping way or not self congratulatory, but the three of us being congratulatory of one another is I saw Joel's review of it. So I was like, what is this? And because, you know, I'm kicking myself because I remember seeing it in our theaters in Appleton for like a week. And I was like, oh, I should go see that. And then I think I looked and I was like, okay, I should go see it because people are seeming to like it a little bit. And then I noticed that just like none of us or, you know, any of us in that circle had seen it yet. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, I'll go see something else instead. And next thing I knew, it was gone. And because it was only in the theaters for like a week here, you know, I'm assuming it's because basically it didn't perform. And so then our, you know, chain of theaters pulled it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the reason that it kind of caught on with me is, and Joel had a lot of high praise for it. So, and I was like, oh, you know, and it's a musical too. And it's like 80s music. So it's like, that's perfect. So, you know, so that's kind of how I heard about it. And then I decided to finally see it and it lived up to everything that I expected it to be. It took me, you know, the name didn't register until after I'd seen the movie, but I finally realized that, oh man, this is the guy who made Begin Again and Once. Like, I didn't even realize it was John Carney. Like, the name didn't click until after I'd seen the movie and was kind of just looking into it a little bit more. But then I'm like, oh, okay, well, if I had known that, I probably would have gone and seen it, you know, back when it came out in, what was it, like April? I think it was like in April or May release or something like that. I think it was even sooner than that.
I'm going to say, I meant to look that up, actually. Unless you just know off the top of your head, Joel.
I think it was released sometime in April or May. Because I know that my review came out in May, just before the summer, all the blockbusters hit. Well, Josh, that's actually really encouraging. That's, I guess, what film criticism is supposed to do, right? Like, we talk about films, we write about films.
Exactly.
Sometimes people haven't heard of them, or it wouldn't be on somebody's radar.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, this worked, sure. So that's a good thing.
I'm not sure why I wasn't aware that this movie was coming either, you know? Like, all of this stuff clicked afterwards.
It wasn't very well marketed, to be honest. I think I saw one trailer in theaters at one point, and even the way that it was done, it looked a bit cheesy. And if I didn't know that John Carney directed it, because that popped up at some point in the trailer, it's directed by John Carney, the guy who directed Once, I probably just would have chalked it up to some weird indie film that I don't really need to go check out. But because of his involvement, you know, and I love Once, and actually had the opportunity to go see The Swell Season after they won the Oscar for Once. Mm-hmm. And when I was living in Phoenix, and they came out and did a concert, and it was amazing. Again, one of the best, like, top five concerts I've ever seen. And so since then, I've been following what John Carney does. Saw Begin Again, and I liked that. And then I think I'm one of the only people who does really like Begin Again. It's gotten a lot of flack, but
I enjoyed it. We actually, so I went and Laura and I actually sat down and watched Begin Again, because I was like, everyone's talking about how great Sing Street is, and I have forgotten. It was like on my list of things to see. What was it, 2014, I'm guessing? And I just never got around to it. So I was like, we're going to watch it. I was like, oh man, this is actually pretty good. And I can see like some definite, it's not like Once, but it is kind of like Once in a way that we can probably compare a little bit later in the show. But it definitely made me feel things, and the music made me feel things. And so it got me excited to see Sing Street. Even though I looked it up, and Sing Street, according to IMDb, has a March 17th release date for Ireland. Doesn't say anything about American release date, and which would lead me to believe, as I would not be hard pressed to be convinced of, that it had almost zero marketing actually in America, because I don't remember seeing a preview for it. I only knew about the movie because a couple people in our Real World Theology group were talking about it, and I saw some critic reviews of it, and people being like, you haven't seen Sing Street? And I'm like, no, I don't. I live in a place where we don't get movies from Ireland. That was unfortunate. And actually, Josh, have you seen Begin Again?
Yeah, I did. I don't remember why I saw it. I remember, I think it was on Amazon Prime or Netflix for a little while, and I had heard such differing things about it. And I was like, okay, well, I got to see this movie, because there's some people that really think it's great and other people that hate it so much. Like, I think one critic called it a nuclear holocaust. I really liked I didn't see what the deal was. I could see maybe where some people would have some issues with it, but I really thought, again, and this is, you know, a strength of Sing Street, it's so Carney has this way with his movies of putting a smile on your face and not letting you lose it for the rest of the film. You know, if someone walked in and be like, what are you grinning at? You know? So that's how I've felt with his movies, and especially these last two, is I really, both of them resonated a lot with me. And I liked Sing Street more than I liked Begin Again. But I liked Begin Again quite a bit more than a lot of people did.
Well, let me ask you guys this. So along the lines of us basically not hearing about Sing Street in any kind of normal movie marketing kind of way, did you guys hear about Morris from America?
Oh, yeah. I had Morris from America just because I liked Chad Hartigan's film. This is Martin Bonner, so I was kind of following up on what he's been up to, and heard about it being released at Sundance, and got some decent reviews, not great reviews, but decent. But even I just love coming of age films too. I work in youth ministry. I'm a youth pastor, and coming of age stories kind of draw me in. And so anything about teenagers, you know, middle schoolers, high schoolers, people going through that season of life of adolescence kind of just stand out to me. So I had heard of that. I don't know that it's been released up in the Portland area yet. And so I've been trying to figure out how to be able to see that, because that's something I want to watch before the end of the year, because I imagine it could be a contender for one of my favorite films, just knowing the material and knowing the director. Like, I love This is Martin Bonner, so it's anything like that.
According to IMDb, you can watch it now on Amazon Video for $6.99.
Well, there you go. Well, then I need to do that on Amazon Video.
Go ahead, Josh.
I was going to say that I actually saw that at the Wisconsin Film Festival, which was and actually the reason that I bought a ticket for it was because of the fact I had seen This is Martin Bonner. And I really, really liked that film, and I liked Chad Hartigan's direction. And I'll leave. So I had heard of it. So it's kind of like cheating, you know, that you hear about it months and months and months before it comes out in theaters. So, but I withhold my opinion to not paint Joel's opinion too much of the movie.
Oh, I'm jumping right in to paint Joel's opinion. I really enjoyed Morris from America. And actually, I saw it like the day after I saw Sing Street. And I think I commented in our group thread, like, I feel like these make like a great double feature, because they're both coming of age films. They're set in not America, which is great, but they have, you can tell where the American influence is butting up against another culture, which is kind of interesting and cool. And it obviously gives a very different look culturally at what it is to what it means to grow up and to be a dad and to be a family and just kind of find your way in a world. Being young's hard. Like, I know, like, being older, we kind of go, like, your problems aren't really that problems. You know, I walked to school through the snow and on thumbtacks and all that. All the things that we would say as middle-er-ish aged people comparatively. But, I mean, like, when you're young, being young is hard sometimes. And I think both these films do something that I haven't seen coming-of-age films do in quite a while. And while we're not going to spoil or really talk about Morris from America, I was just curious because, like I said, it also came out this year. It also was coming of age. It also dealt with, you know, people in like a different, in this case, Germany. And I felt like no one had heard of it. And that was really weird, because whenever I see a good film, I just want people to know about it. So if you haven't seen Morris from America, I would recommend it. We're not going to talk about it on the show. We're talking about Sing Street, which we have actually all seen. And deals with a group of kids growing up in Ireland in the 80s, which is also a different way to look at it. And I feel like this looking at it from a different lens has given people some creative license to actually make us feel things that we don't feel as easily when we watch typical, you know, like coming-of-age films set in the present day. Especially in our case. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, or at least the late 80s. And so some of this wasn't foreign to me, even though I didn't live in Ireland. And I don't, you know, I think Josh is like, you're like 18 now, so you probably don't remember the 80s. So that's unfortunate.
Yes, I might look 18, but I am actually only 2 years younger than you.
Allegedly. Well, so, okay, yeah. So the description of a film like Sing Street says, a boy growing up in Dublin during the 1980s escapes his strained family life by starting a band to impress the mysterious girl he likes. So besides the fact that it's, like, in Dublin and in the 80s, the rest of it is basically just, like, a movie we've seen 100 times before. But I wish I could remember. I think it was you, Josh, who was kind of pointing out that John Carney has a way to put like a smile on her face, but, and it doesn't really leave for most of the film. And while I think that's a good observation, I think it's important to note that even though I'm kind of smiling or at least smirking through most of John Carney's films, I'm not always smirking and smiling because I'm happy. Like, it has this thing that lots of reviewers, including Joel, and not just Joel, though, are referring to that John Carney does, called happy sad. So, Joel, I'm kind of hoping you can kind of describe happy sad for us.
I mean, it kind of captures it in just the word, or the mashup of that word, right? Like, it's being happy and being sad at the same time, and that comes from the film. Like, two of the teenagers are talking about this and what their art and their music really entails and how they feel. And I think that's what the best art does, is it starts to capture a variety of emotions and communicates mm-hmm. things that we just can't communicate necessarily with our words, but it, particularly music, communicates things that go beyond words, with the rhythms and the beats and the melodies and harmonies and all those different things that come together. And so that happy, sad characteristic, like, I can't think of a film this year that made me feel as good as I felt walking out of the theater. Like, I definitely had a big grin on my face. I'm, you know, singing along or humming the words to Drive It Like You Stole It. And I still mm-hmm. have that song, or I still have that soundtrack. And I was listening to it today when I was picking up my daughter from preschool. We were humming it on the way back home.
I must have listened to that like 5 times today.
it's just so catchy. It's just a pop song that gets stuck in your head and you don't mind it being there. But there's also that sadness part too. Like, there's a lot of stuff that the main character Connor has to deal with in this film. Like, his parents are getting divorced. He has to move schools. The school that he's at is just, you know, it's hard to make friends. There's a priest there that is honestly abusive and violent and scary. Mm-hmm. There's bullies that he has to deal with. It's, some of that's kind of cliche, but it's also cliche because that's what we deal with as teenagers. And I think anybody who is willing to go back to remember the emotions that they were feeling when they were during those years of adolescence, this film kind of captures that. So it's all that variety of emotion kind of crammed into one film, but not in a way that feels overwhelming or overly sentimental. It's just, it's fun. It's just genuinely fun and a feel-good movie. And it captures that in a really remarkable way.
Mm. So Josh, like, when you're watching a movie like Sing Street and it's doing the happy sad thing, are you able to kind of remove yourself from that emotion and say, oh man, that this is really great, this character's going through it? Or does it connect with you because it takes you personally back to that time in your life?
Yeah, I think it's kind of both of those things. I think that I'm able to remove myself, first of all, you know, just because I'm capturing kind of like it's capturing a lot of the memories that I had, you know, being a kid. And I think there's another part is you have a certain amount of grace for a coming of age film. At least I do. I mean, I guess I should say, like, I would hope that most people would have this kind of mentality, is you have a certain amount of grace, because when you're growing up, you look at the world, like, you might be growing in your complexity and understanding the world, but you still look at it a little bit more simply than you do when you're, you know, in your late 20s, early 30s and onwards. You know, there's a certain amount of, this movie is the perspective of a teenager or a youth or whatever you want to call them. And so there's a certain amount of disbelief that I can suspend for this movie, both because mm-hmm. it's bringing me back. And then also it's because, oh, like, I understand that more now because I have kids too. Like, oh yeah, you know, like, I'm raising kids to, like, see the world in a more complex and more complex way to understand this world. Because when you're a kid, you understand it very simply. And when you think back to being a kid, you're like, man, you know, like, when you wonder about, like, why didn't I ever think about that my parents think about the things that I do, you know? And now, and I think back, oh, it's because, you know, I was a kid, I was learning, I was growing, I was learning to understand the world. And so I thought about it very simply. And so I like it when movies don't try to adult the way that youth and teens think about the world, but they try to kind of capture what a teen or a youth thinks about the world at that age. Mm-hmm. And so that's why there's a certain amount of just happiness, you know, that comes with it too. But this idea of happy sad is kind of in this movie. It's, you know, Connor or Cosmo, as he comes to be called later in the film. You know, it's kind of his way of starting to understand the world more. There's like new layers of the world that are being developed for him. And I'm able to suspend that disbelief and really just enjoy it and harken back to the days when I thought a lot more simply about the world, you know?
Well, there was, I think too, like because of the genre of what it is, like it really is a musical. And so even going back to some of those classic musicals, Mikey, like you mentioned, you know, Singing in the Rain and The Sound of Music, that are where people will randomly burst into song, or there will be this large musical number, and sometimes about the simplest things, or sometimes about things that, you know, the lyrics aren't necessarily overly complex. But that's kind of what this film does too. There's so much music in it, and there's so much of that music is meant to communicate what Connor is going through and what the other teen characters are going through as well, and tries to capture that in song and in music and in dance and choreography. And the film just kind of embraces that. And so it feels like a series of, honestly, it feels like a series of music videos in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're making a comment on that too. You know, the whole video killed the radio star kind of idea of creating a music video and what that can mean. But there's something about that, that like, I get what Josh is saying. Like, I get what you're saying, man, with the simplicity, but there's a complexity here too. Like it's, and maybe that's happy, sad too, that paradox of it's both and, like it's simple. And some of the things are really simple here. Like a boy is going to meet a girl and he's going to fall in love. And we've all seen that story, but there's some complex stuff that's going on here too, when it comes to identity formation and art. Just the film is a statement on what art is and what it does for us, and how we create it and how it creates us. It is actually pretty deep when we want to stop and think about it, but it's yeah, also really basic and simple too, and somehow yeah, manages sure to be both. I don't know how it does that so well, but it does.
Yeah, and I think that's the part that I don't want to overstate it, in the sense that like there's not a lack of complexity in this film. I'm just saying, you know, like a lot of times people there can be this need to sort of to over adult.
Yeah, not like kids perspective. Be kids.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's what I enjoy about coming of age films, is kind of the youthful vigor of, you know, there's a certain amount of like, I remember when I used to do that stuff, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. But it's also the complexity that you're talking about, where there's so many things at play, like, oh yeah, like, you know, all these different things, like with their parents and, you know, you think you see those things, and or like you said about just the value of music, we don't get that really as much when we're a kid as we do when we're an adult. And then we start to realize how much music has influenced us or affected us. You know, when you hear an old song and it all the memories rush back, or the tears well up again, or things like that, you know. So I'm trying not to undersell this movie as simplistic. So. Yeah.
Well, it's really funny too, because when I think back to my youth, as cool or as, no, I didn't actually think I was that cool. When I you know, as smart as I thought I probably was, or as smart aleck as I thought I was, like music, or this being a musical, helps in a lot of ways, because music really was a big part of my youth. You know, like that's why we always say, oh, music is never, you know, like the music of my time is always way better than the music of like our kids' time. Like, oh, they don't make music like they used to. And every generation says that, because music when we're young makes a huge impact. And specifically, I love how if I think about it, which I have, that there's a lot of things that as a teenager I didn't have the vocabulary or life experience for, and I could use music to express those things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the most cliche thing is like the mixtape, you know, you're like, oh, I like this girl so much, but that's basically your vocabulary for it when you're 15, right? You're like, I like you so much. Absolutely. And that's basically the extent of your Shakespeare. So you basically go and you find all these people who have written these lyrics that evoke emotion and hopefully express this thing that you don't quite understand to this person that you don't understand in a way that you hope makes them understand. And it just... it's a very powerful thing. So it's very interesting that John Carney, starts with Once in a film that we can get attached to because of the music, and Begin Again to find people, adults, connecting over music. But it seems appropriate and probably most apt that he finally makes a film about an age group where music is the thing. I mean, like, when you think about people who are buying, like, music from iTunes, or at least using their parents' credit card for buying music from iTunes and things like that. Like, when I was a teenager, I never went anywhere without my Walkman or my Discman or my iPod, whatever it was at the time. And now that I'm older, I'm like, whatever, maybe I'll listen to a podcast. I want to listen to adults talk about things instead of just listening to music all the time. I can't go to a high school Joel, you're probably better experience at this, but I have seen very few youth groups where kids aren't listening to music on their phone or sharing music with each other all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's the constant earbud in your ear kind of phenomenon that happens now. And it's so for me too. I was a musician. I started playing drums in middle school, and that was something for me growing up that was just a way of expressing those emotions dealing with the tension of growing up in a way that it goes beyond words, or I couldn't express it in a better way. So instead of writing journals or stuff like that, I hit things really hard with drumsticks and got into bands and that kind of thing. And so totally, I resonate with that. And so when I watch a film like this, there is a part of me that I guess empathizes with that, or does put myself in that position of what it was like to be a teen, to play music, to make music, to create something and try to communicate that to somebody else, whether that's, parents and how angry I am, or whether that's, bullies, or the girl that you like and how much you care about them, but you don't know how to say that, or you can't say that because you're so scared, or this film, I think, captures some of that. And it does something else too that I was probably my favorite scene of the film. There's this kind of musical fantasy prom scene moment where there's a choreographed dancing and everybody in the film, whether they've, been the antagonists or bullies or off on the sidelines or whatever, all come together and they're all singing and dancing along, and Connor's on the stage and everything's going awesome for him. And I think that is a good picture of what a lot of teenagers actually deal with, this idea of a fantasy world of, if I could be that cool person that's on the stage, or that sense of everybody is watching me, everybody is noticing me, for better or for worse, and I wish it could be this way. And I thought that scene is probably one of my favorite scenes of any film this year, just the way that it captured the emotion of that moment in the film in particular, but also the way that it captures that very human emotion of wanting something to be like this ideal reality and not being able to get there, but maybe for a moment in that music getting lost in that ideal reality and that fantasy world, and maybe just kind of capturing a glimpse of it. I love that moment and think it really captures kind of the essence of the entire film right in that scene.
Mm. So it seems like we're all kind of saying that, or at least pointing out or pointing to this idea that music not just elevates, but almost transcends circumstance, or has the ability to. It seems like, at least in Sing Street to me, that John Carney uses music almost like this metaphor for hope. Or maybe escape. And I'm just curious if that's what I'm seeing. Josh, like, what do you see music, what kind of role do you see music playing? Like, what kind of hope does music offer for, like, the teenagers in this film? because Joel, I mean, Joel's talked a little bit about, it seems like that there's this perfection that may be required through being the center of attention and playing this music. But is there anything else that you saw?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I think the music is very specific in what it's trying to say. I know that, like, briefly, Mikey, you and I had a conversation on Sunday over Facebook about the 20th anniversary of Pinkerton coming out, which Weezer was my favorite band growing up. And, like, you know, I kind of jokingly said at the end of our conversation that Rivers Cuomo is my Patronus. You know, I've kind of, I've always grown up as, like, Rivers somehow through the mystery of time and living in the same time and him creating, that somehow we were connected. And, like, I felt so many of the things that he said in his albums. And, you know, Pinkerton was kind of like this confessional album for him, and it really did a lot for me personally when I was growing up. I wasn't a Christian at the time either, but there was kind of this spiritual connection between that I always felt between him and I, as far as like music went. But like specifically in this movie, you know, they're going with this, it's a lot of, you know, new wave, or that MTV, early MTV 1985 music that was very much, you know, it's kind of like the tail end of new wave, but became incredibly influential later on. And I like how you phrased it as like music gives hope, in the sense that maybe it is kind of a little bit of an escape, to escape, you know, he's kind of escaping the reality of his kind of brutal life, or I guess not brutal, you know, it's kind of always makes me think of, I couldn't escape from this fact that, you know, even though he was kind of poor, it makes me think of growing up. And I think of Ben Folds' line in Rocking the Suburbs, where he's like, let me tell you all what it's like being male, middle class and white, yeah. You know, just kind of like this ironic twist on the fact that like, we really don't have it that bad, but we think we have it that bad kind of thing. But, you know, he's trying to get out of this. He's escaping a little bit and finding hope in something better than his life, where he gets transferred to a new school, his parents are fighting, and, you know, eventually split up in this movie. And, but I think also a lot, something I really enjoyed in the movie, and Joel, you had kind of mentioned this in passing as you were talking about the complexity of the movie, but how it deals a lot with how we find our identity in music. And I love how the movie progresses through this. Like, his brother, which I'm hoping we'll come back to talk about his brother a little bit more. But, you know, how his brother will give him a lesson in music or whatever. And then, you know, the next scene he's dressed up like, you know, he's dressed up like the band that he just listened to. So he's like, he's dressed up kind of like Duran Duran. And then another party's dressed up like The Cure. Mm-hmm. And then another party's dressed up like Hall and Oates. And it's like, you know, like, oh man, I want to go get my blazer and roll up the sleeves, you know, like a Miami Vice Hall and Oates kind of thing going on. But there's this real significance in finding music gives us a bit of an identity. And, you know, the music that really sticks with us also comes with like an understanding of how we see and view the world, and both how we dress ourselves and all these other things like that. So I think there's this real strong connection of how music doesn't just give us hope, but it gives us identity. And those things are kind of wrapped up together. You know, I mean, if we look at it from a Christian perspective, you know, a lot of our identity is wrapped up in the hope of Christ. So the same way, you know, music can impact us in that way, where it not just forms how we think, but it informs how we dress, how we approach the world, all these different things. And it can be extremely significant. And I found that part infectious and so true, thinking back to my own growing up. Mm-hmm. I wished so badly that I had needed glasses when I was in high school, so I could wear glasses like Rivers Cuomo did. But you know, you definitely like kind of embrace that a little bit. I think about, you know, like the mid to early 90s when, you know, I was in middle school, everyone wore grunge, you know, to be like Nirvana. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that same thing where music sort of captures this big cultural imagination sometimes, or it can, you know, influence the cultural imagination. And it not is just cultural, but it can come down to an individual level where, you know, that individual person, where in this case it's Connor, he's sort of embracing the viewpoint of a certain artist at a certain point in time, and trying to find his identity, and trying to, it's almost like trying it out a little bit. Like, does this work for me? You know, when you're a kid, like, does this work for me? I'll try this out and see if this works. And I really loved that part of it so much.
So I guess a follow-up question to that is, the way you're describing it, Josh, is music is so powerful that people are easily swayed into basically forming their identity around it. So how is music not a bad thing? Do the puritanical people actually have it right? Like, we shouldn't actually be listening to the rock and roll?
Oh man, that's a hilarious question. You know, coming from where I come from it personally,
too close to home.
It's too close to home, man. Gosh, you know, I don't necessarily think that's the case. I mean, you know, maybe if this was a movie about like death metal or something like that, maybe we would. Or maybe if it was like about, I mean, I think about any movie that sort of like plays with the idea of like identity formation and something maybe that we don't like. Mm-hmm. That would be a harder film to watch for us, but maybe would be just as poignant. But though we probably wouldn't have a smile on our face the whole time.
So you're okay with this good music as idols. So it's okay to worship idols. That's what I'm hearing, Josh.
Man, you are raking me over the coals right now.
Can I come to Josh's defense?
Absolutely. Please do. Cause he's killing me right now.
I think with this, like, beyond just music, it's not just listening to music and letting that shape your identity. It's also the creation of music. Mm-hmm. Like he creates a band and forms this, you know, ragtag group that starts making this different, I don't even know what kind of genre. They call themselves a futurist band, but whatever that means.
Which
it's
is
basically
great.
A mashup of anything that they can figure out that week. But that is identity forming and shaping. But it's also, you know, not in a sense of that shapes them from the outside and they can't help themselves, but it's this dialogue that goes on with the art. And so even the idea of escaping from reality, I don't think it's so much an escape as it is dealing with the reality that he's living in. And I found this quote. I was trying to look up stuff to remember from this, and there's a quote, and I'm gonna bleep it out for you a bit, if that's okay.
That's fine.
And Connor's talking about this, and it says, it means that I'm stuck in this blank hole full of morons and rapists and bullies, and I'm going to deal with it, okay? It's just how life is. I'm going to try and accept this and get on with it and make some art. And his friend, one of the most musically talented guys, Eamon, in the band, says, how does that affect our music? And Connor responds, positively. And I think that that's what art in its best form is supposed to do. It's helping us to accept the reality, not escape from the reality, but to see reality with clear eyes and a better focus and a new perspective, and then also help shape or change that reality, hopefully in a more hopeful way. So it's not just fleeing reality and running away from it. It's using this music to actually better engage with reality and to shape his identity in healthier ways. And you can see that over the course of the film, mm-hmm. like Connor at the beginning versus Cosmo at the end, and just his level of self-confidence, his relationships with his friends, his relationships with his brother in particular, his relationships with this girl, Rafina. He's a different person. He's grown up, you know? And I think, coming back to your original statement, is this an idol in his life? I think it could be if music becomes the end in and of itself. But when music and art is a means to an end, it's an understanding of what truth is and beauty and goodness in our world. And it's recognizing the transcendent in that. I think that that's a healthy thing, and can be beneficial. It's a dangerous thing, as well, I guess. Like, it affects us. I think, Brendan, his brother's older brother, it's on the soundtrack. It opens up, says rock and roll is a risk.
Yeah.
And that's
risk
what this
being
is.
Ridiculed.
Like, yeah. You risk being ridiculed. And it is that way, right? Like, art, anytime that we engage with it, is a risk. And if it's not a risk, I'm not sure that we're really fully engaging with it.
I like what you're saying, because you're not saying anything about worship, but I'm sitting here listening, trying to apply what you're saying about the worship that we sing, like in church or, you know, whatever, our youth groups or whatever. And I feel like that is a great lesson on the importance and why we have worship. Because, you know, we're discovering these truths, we're saying these truths. Music is helping us understand truth. It's helping us express something or repeat something or memorize something that we know to be true, or we want to be true, or we feel to be true. And the repetition of that, the proclamation of that, the connection with that is transcendent, or can be transcendent. And that's why I think, you know, even if people aren't singing about God, they can feel like a truth in the music. I mean, obviously there's a lot of leeway here and a lot of nuance to it, because it depends on, you know, what they're singing and how they're singing. But even then, if they're singing things that we would say are not true, there's not a discovery, but like a yearning or a longing that they're typically hunting for. I mean, I think about being young and listening to lots of the songs that, like, anytime I would listen to what I'd call sad bastard music, you know, just like if a girl like started going out with one of my friends and I thought she was super cute and I thought she was going to go out with me, I would, you know, listen to this song about how girls just don't understand and they never like the nice guy. And I that's not really true, like, in that situation, but I was searching for something to give me an emotion or give me an outlet or make me feel something that I wanted to be true. And if you kind of like wrangle that back in, when we're singing words that are true about the creator of the universe, I think it has a profound effect on us. Because it's more than just a hope in an escape or a searching, but it's a proclamation. And I think when you proclaim things, it has a mighty power to do awesome things, especially in us personally as we explore that. And that's what I was thinking when you were talking, Joel, so I'm glad you let me say that.
Well, no, and I think with music in particular, like, we have the biggest book of the Bible is Psalms, right? Like, there's it's a song book, and there's poetry, and that does express something that's even beyond proclamation, because even beyond words, can we express the truths of God and the beauty of God and the beauty of the created world around us without words? Can we do that? And I've wrestled with that being a drummer and playing drums in church worship services, where I've had people literally stand up and walk out with their, you know, hands over their ears, because grew up in a fairly conservative Baptist setting and didn't resonate with a lot of the older folks. This guy that's hitting these cymbals, which is one of the most biblical instruments. You know, if you read Psalm 150, there's resounding gongs and resounding cymbals and clanging cymbals, all sorts of fun stuff in there about percussion.
So it sounds like you're bringing your truth to the Bible instead of taking the Bible from, or the truth from the Bible itself.
No, I'm just reading Psalm 150 trying to apply it. It says, praise the Lord with the resounding cymbals, and I'm going to find some cymbals and hit them. so even that, like, how does that express the goodness and beauty and truth of God by hitting a piece of metal with a stick? Normally, I think, at least in evangelical Christian circles, there's this idea that it's very word-based and text-based, and, you know, the truth is based on information and theology and doctrine, and that's good. That is true and is part of what how we express the reality of who God is. But if God also seems to include things like hitting cymbals as expressions of how to worship God, then I think we do have to be open to the reality that music offers something way bigger than just, you know, words on a page or sermons preached. This is not necessarily connected a ton with Sing Street, but I do think that what they are doing in that film is true to their own teenage experiences. And that's what made me love it so much is it feels very authentic for all the, you know, the formal aspects where there are fantasy sequences like the prom thing and they break into music video moments and there's a lot of montages that go on and even some of the ways that the camera works. There's some really interesting moments where they're playing together in a band and the camera just spins in a circle in a 360 degree kind of moment and you know, the band members are changing and they're growing and the song is evolving as they're going with that. I, even in that formal setting, I think it does capture the truth of what music at its best can do for us. And I think that's why John Carney's films just really resonate with me. Like they capture that, that what it feels like to be a musician and to try to express the truth of experience and reality the way that I see it through this not nonverbal because there's singing and there's poetry that's involved with that, but the musical aspect of it, you know, playing guitars and hitting just the right melodies and building in crescendos and those things communicate beauty as well. And yet words can't really capture how and why that connects with us so much.
Huh. I'm really glad that you pointed that out because it seems so obvious now that you're saying it and that you're adding the entire musician piece to it, that it's so much more than words, even though the focus, especially in worship, since I brought it up, is almost always on words because as a musician, I think that's my go-to anecdote. Like we'll get together with family or something and they know that I play in the worship band at church and they're like, oh, well just, what are some of the songs that you like to play? And I'm like, I honestly do not know. They're like, what about this song? And like I said, the bad part of this anecdote is I probably should know more words to some of these songs, but I like when they'll say the name of a song, I really don't remember it. I remember the rhythm that I'm playing, on the drums and I'm worshiping, but the words, you know, the words aren't my expression. The hitting, you know, hitting the drum for me is this cathartic, very expressive way that I can, like not cry out, but like act out, to the creator of the universe. Mm-hmm. It's something, you know, I feel like I don't even think about it. It's just something that comes naturally. It's one of the few times that I'm actually, doing something where I feel like God created me and I'm using this gift that he has given me, naturally in response. And like I said, the bad part of that is I probably should know more of the words to the songs, because those are kind of important. But as a musician, there is this beauty in that not being the only way that I can express that. And music allowing me to do that. So
totally. I think there is something like you're in talk about it, like losing yourself in the music in the moment, you know. I'm not going to keep going, but
I was like, how far is this going to go?
But there is something transcendent in that we get caught up in this, you know, this effervescent kind of feeling. And that's what I think Sing Street really captures too. Like just these teen kids are caught up in these moments it's hard to describe, like, are they caught up in a more real reality when they're playing that music, or are they escaping from reality? And that's kind of the question I think you asked earlier about, is this an escape for them or not? I still think it's more that they're becoming in tune with a different aspect of reality or seeing reality on a different level. But I think that happens in worship too, or when we're playing music and we're doing it well, especially if that's something that we're doing for the glory of God. And yeah, knowing the words I think is important too, right? It's not mutually exclusive, but there's moments where, you know, you're just playing something and you are caught up in that, in the rhythm or the beat or the melody, the harmony, the feeling, which is so hard to describe. But when you've experienced that, and you, whether that's at a concert or whether that's driving in the car and listening to something and you find yourself overwhelmed and crying while you're in your commute. Not that that's ever happened to me, but
to other people that I've heard of.
Hypothetically, like those are those moments where you've hit on something that goes beyond even just the senses, that there's a spiritual encounter that happens there. And I think that that's pretty remarkable. And I think Sing Street captures some of those moments, even when it's not really intending. It's actually pretty critical of religion in a lot of ways, in the way that it portrays the cliche abusive, angry Catholic priest who's overseeing the school and is just a huge jerk. Yeah. It's, you know, religion doesn't really come off very pleasant in the film, but that doesn't mean spirituality and truth aren't there.
Yeah.
Even in that.
Yeah, so, I think the whole process is just kind of about, or some of the more genuine moments are those creative moments. I think maybe that the favorite scene, Joel, you and I share that favorite scene of kind of that magical reality. I almost felt like it was more of like a magical reality, you know, like it wasn't dreamy. Like they didn't have like clouds floating around, or it wasn't like some weird sort of camera work to kind of make it seem like it was a dream. It very much felt like a reality. And I think maybe that moment is an escape to maybe what music could potentially do for his entire reality. Mm-hmm. But the more authentic moments of the movie are where he's creating. Like, I really love the moments where he's sitting and like working out the songs with Eamon, you know, on the guitar and working these out. And you're really seeing like, or there's like that really special, like one little moment where he's with his art teacher, you know, and she says like, you know, girls are really complicated. And he kind of has the camera gets like that one moment where he like is like, that would be a great song lyric. And then of course it's a song, you know,
in the
movie. And so it's kind of like this, oh, like there's something true. I'm going to create out of that. And I think that's what you were really getting at that I really enjoyed about this movie. But I think that you've eloquently proven that calling it escaping is maybe not the best terminology for it.
Well, I think what this conversation has started to remind me of is something that I don't really like that pastors do a lot of time, but it's inevitable and sometimes helpful, which is when they go and they watch a movie and they take like one quote out of it and they use it. In this particular case, it's one of the ones that I've heard quoted more than anything else in the world, which is weird to have it current because it's not a current movie, but there's that line in Chariots of Fire when Eric Liddell is talking about running and he says, "I believe God made me for a purpose, but he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure." Mm-hmm. And when all these conversations about music and creating art, like, I feel like that's a quote that sums up how I feel about when I'm creating art, when I'm playing percussion or guitar or whatever, when I'm playing, I'm creating music. That would be how I describe it. I feel like he made me for something, and when I do it, I feel his pleasure. I mean, I could call it catharsis. I could call it a great feeling. I could say I lose myself in the music. But I think that's what it is. I feel his pleasure. I feel whatever that is that doesn't make it seem weird, but makes it seem honest. With that, I definitely don't want to wrap us up, but I usually start with that and then wrap us up. I want to make sure that we talk about the family dynamic in this, because we talked a lot about the music. We talked about like his not escapism, but kind of like discovering truth through through music. But I want to talk about what he's kind of almost trying to deal with, and that's this family aspect. It's not pretty. You know, his parents are basically divorcing. I think by the end of the film, they are divorced or whatever. Or at least separated. But Josh, can you talk a little bit about the relationship that Connor, our main character, has with Brendan, his brother?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, before I say anything about it, but that by far was my favorite performance in the entire movie. Like, where did
Brendan,
they find
his
this
brother?
Yeah, where did they find this guy? Where did they find the Irish Chris Pratt, you know? Like, that's essentially what he looked like, and with a little bit longer hair. You know, he's got this relationship, and it's interesting how by the end of the movie, I was resonating less with Connor and more with his older brother, being an older brother myself. You know, so I sort of had this teary moment at the end of the film, but it was for his brother Brendan instead of him. And he's got this incredibly interesting relationship where, you know, his brother is sort of like a mentor. You know, that's what every big brother wants to be. And it really put me to shame because it makes me think I wasn't really the best brother to my younger brother. But then I'm like, no, I don't think so. Because when I get together with my brother, all we have to do is make a reference to The Simpsons. And immediately, like, we both understand that still to this very day, you know? So it's like I must have mentored him well because we still remember lines from Simpsons episodes from like 15, 20 years ago. But, you know, I love the relationship in the fact that they are doing this again. Like you said, Joel, or they're sort of dealing with the reality of their parents and essentially their parents being incredibly selfish to a certain extent and really bonding over music. And I even find it one of my favorite scenes in this movie is the scene where Brendan and Connor and their sister, who I'm can't remember her name because she's not in a lot of scenes in the movie. There's a moment where their parents are fighting and screaming at each other, and the three of them are in the room and they just blast the music and start dancing together, you know? And it's this moment where the music sort of brings them together in the midst of this terrible reality. And they just share this moment of being able to dance to music with one another in the middle, while you kind of hear the muffled fighting under the music during that scene. And I just love how that, again, bringing it back to music, we can't escape the fact that music is obviously a huge part of this movie, but it draws them together and helps them to, I would say, cope to a certain extent, but also embrace the reality of the fact that their parents aren't together. And they have all these amazing moments together where Brendan's sharing his musical knowledge with Connor and sort of, you know, philosophizing about music and, you know, tells him what creation is all about, you know, when he scolds him for trying to use other people's art to get a girl. I thought that was great. But, you know, there's this moment, and this is my, I think, the most impactful scene in the movie for me, and what made me resonate with Brendan, is the point in the movie where I think it's after their parents announce that they're separating. And, you know, or, you know, Connor's making some really good music at this point in the movie. And Brendan has this moment where he essentially just lays into Connor for being successful, for being liked and being cheered and applauded and everything like that, you know. And he ends that with saying, like, you know, you may be successful now, but you need to remember that I was a jet engine, you know, basically saying, like, I used to be something and I paved this path for you. And that's, when you're an older sibling, you get that when you have younger siblings. Like, you love and you care for them, but there's a little bit of resentment that you have for your younger siblings because you're the one that blazed the path sometimes for your older siblings. And I love that moment where it's like, you know, he says, but he also adds in there, it's okay that you're better than me, but you need to remember that I was a jet engine. And that really has the big payoff at the end of the movie, you know, when he sort of gets that chance to create and makes those lyrics that he gives to Connor before Connor leaves with Ruffina. And that has to be my favorite relationship in this entire movie, is the two of them and just how they go through this time together and they're cheering for one another. But there's also just a little bit of that real animosity as a result of Connor's success and living out the dreams that Brendan had to leave behind. And again, I just love how it's all bonded over music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to follow up with that, that it's their relationship as brothers is something that's so unique on film. 'Cause there's a genuine connection or care that happens between them, and the way that the both actors perform that, you know, there's a chemistry there, and you can't really teach that. It's just something that they must have worked out together in creating the film. There's just such a strong connection between the two of them. And Brendan, Josh, like you said, that moment where he kind of lays into him and says, "I've blazed this path," and you're kind of, if he's the jet engine, like Connor's in the jet stream and
yeah,
following behind. And yet it's not like there's a sadness to it, but this is that happy, sad thing. Like there's a regret that, that he's recognizing that his little brother is going to achieve things that he never will achieve or hasn't achieved. But he's also celebrating that. And so there's a sadness that Brendan personally hasn't accomplished those things, but Connor will. And it's not a jealousy thing. It's just a, this is awesome. Like my little brother is going to do amazing thing. He's going to get the girl. He's going to go off and make something of himself. And by the end, get that sense with Brendan that he is his greatest, he's Connor's biggest cheerleader, right? He's the champion for him.
Yeah. Like that moment where he, you know, Connor sort of like gets out of his view as he's heading out in the ocean and he just kind of like pumps his fist and says, yes. Like,
yeah,
that could have been played really corny. Or if it hadn't been done so well throughout the movie, it would have felt disingenuous. But in that moment, it felt so genuine that he would be like, yes, you know, my younger brother is going to achieve the things I never did. And I'm genuinely happy for him. Like that clearly, like you said, it was because of how well the whole, it was played throughout the course of the movie. Otherwise that moment would not have paid off as well as it did.
I think that's one of the hardest parts for me because I feel watching that relationship that it's kind of the relationship that I wish were the case more often. Because it's beautiful. I think especially in film, we often get the an unrealistic look at what those relationships, like just siblings squabbling because it makes for better drama with no compassion. But this very honest look reminds me of being an older brother as well. Like saying recognizing or having those epiphanies, even though I'm trying to act tough or I'm trying to act like I'm the cool one and I've never had it like that hard. But it was incredibly hard being the one who's blazing the path, you know, like you get, you're the trial, right? Like it's like when they joke about parents, all like you're overprotective for the first one, but then, you know, you loosen up with the second or third child and things like that. There's reasons that these are kind of cliche or stereotypes. So going through some of those things, but then stopping and realizing that your younger brother has had a completely different set of experiences because things weren't exactly the same, even though almost it seems like all the variables were the same, is really hard. And it's really hard to be happy for them. And in a loving relationship, you really do want to make it easier. You're almost like a parent. You know, one of the things that often parents will say is, you know, I want you to have a better life than I had. Right. So as an older sibling, I would love to be able to say, I want you to succeed where I failed. I want to be, you know, the Brendan to your Connor. But then at the same time, you kind of don't want to make it that too easy. Right. And that's why I love their interactions between Brendan and Connor. And that's what I think is so endearing, because Brendan is putting up that wall. He's always got something smart to say. He's always got, sarcasm there to battle. He's the only person really talking back to his parents. But when they get alone, even when Connor is making decent music, Brendan keeps being like, well, it's total crap. But it's better, you know, like very backhanded compliments, even though you can kind of tell he's a little bit impressed and he's always pushing him to do more and more. So he's happy that Connor's succeeding, but at the same time, he still doesn't want to just be like, you're doing so great, Connor. You're doing so awesome. You're succeeding at everything. He's kind of he's razzing him a little bit, right? He wants to make him better because he really loves and cares about his brother. And I just feel like it's been a long time since I've seen siblings portrayed this way. And that, I mean, like, it makes me happy that I got to see it in Sing Street, but it makes me sad that I don't see it more often. It's like watching sitcoms where the husband is always like an idiot, and can't do anything right. And the wife's always frustrated with it. And like, somehow these people are married and they're happy. Like, I don't like watching those sitcoms, 'cause I'm like, that's not what we should be going for. That's not what we should be modeling our families after. I want people, even in hard times, to be Brendan and Connor. And I think that was encouraging to me to actually see it, even though it was a happy, sad story, you know?
Well, and like, so the final credits, you know, there's this title at the end that says Four Brothers Everywhere.
Mm. Yeah.
It does seem to be this intentionality on Carney's part to make that story the center of the story. Like, it could have been, you know, a boy and a girl and the Connor and Rafina romance thing. And, you know, maybe the band is going to break up because he has to choose between following the girl or the band, or, you know, that kind of stuff. And it never mm-hmm. goes down any of those cliche routes. It includes Brendan in that story and makes him a fully realized character with a full narrative arc that's included there. And Rafina too, by the way, like, she gives a fairly remarkable performance and isn't just some, you know, cute girl that gets to be the muse for Connor. Like, she's actually a fully realized character with her own story and her own creativity and her own contributions to make. Mm-hmm. But with Brendan and Connor, yeah, I don't know why there aren't more dramas that actually highlight the healthiness of siblings, and not like in just a fake happy sort of way, but in a genuine, we have to wrestle through difficult times together and come out okay on the other side way. And that's what this Connor and Brendan story really highlights, because they do, I mean, they have to navigate their parents splitting up, which is, it's kind of that ordinary everyday thing that is also horrible and traumatic for the family that's involved in that. And we kind of forget how devastating that really is, because it is so commonplace. But the dissolve of a marriage and the dissolve of a family like that, and maybe it is actually a bit applicable that the middle sibling is kind of ignored in the midst of all that, you know, like, the middle child syndrome can happen too. And I wish,
well, she's the one trying to be the achiever, right? To be noticed.
Yeah, she's just very driven and she's very focused on her schoolwork. And doesn't seem to give, the film just doesn't give her as much attention. And that might be if I had any quibbles with the film, it would be that there are some secondary characters, like other members in the band, that and their sister, that the film just doesn't focus on as much. But those are pretty minor and secondary, to be honest, because the fully realized, especially the trinity of Connor, Brendan, Rafina, those three characters in particular are all very charming and affecting, and the performances are solid, and every single, just the dynamic that comes with that feels familiar and yet kind of a new take on a familiar idea or trope. And so I think the film, that's something about it. It's like the best kind of pop song. Like, pop songs, we've all heard these things before. And they feel really familiar and almost simple. And that's what Sing Street really is, but it's still good and sticks with you.
It sticks with you, yeah.
Yeah, because there is something original and unique about it.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So now we are approaching that time where we should wrap up. So I want to ask you one last question, especially Joel, not to dismiss you, Josh, because I would love your thoughts as well. But Joel, since you are, or have been, work with youth for so long, if you watch this movie with your youth group, like, what do you talk to them about after it's over?
That's a fantastic question. I think I would wrestle through each of those different characters, like focusing on Connor and Rafina and Brendan, and ask, if I was with a group of teenagers, ask them to describe what resonated with them and their experiences. Even though this is set in Ireland in 1985, there's something that, well, it is very distinct for that place. And I think the film really does capture that setting and environment and the uniqueness of that. There is something that's a bit universal and timeless about that experience of being a teenager growing up as well. Mm-hmm. And so I would ask which of those things connects with them and their experience of being a teen now. Like, what's the same and what's different? There are these songs that they're listening to and this 80s new wave stuff. And there's a lot of bands nowadays that are coming out with songs that sound a lot like the 80s. And even style-wise, like our fashion sense. We got our, I remember, you know, when these acid wash jeans and skinny jeans started coming back. And I was like, really? People are going to do this? Oh, they are. They're doing this. Okay.
It's happening.
We are wearing neon now, and we are going to probably put scrunchies in our hair, or at least the girls are. I'm not. I can't pull that off. But
these well, not with that attitude, but.
Yeah. Exactly. I need a little bit more spunk.
A little more happy, a little less sad.
Yeah. But with that, I think I'd ask where their experience connects with this film. What hasn't changed since 1985 when it comes to being a teenager, and what has? And then what are the feelings that they've experienced while watching the film, or memories that it conjures up for them, and what do they resonate with? And then I think the film can also be a great conversation piece for art. We talked about that a lot already in this conversation, but what does art really do? Like, what is its purpose? How do we go about that creative process? How has God created us to create? How does that reflect his image in that we're made to create beauty and create music and create pieces of art that connect us to one another and to God better? Those are the kind of questions I think this film, I mean, it's such a simple film, but it has so much depth to it once you really stop and think about it. And then we probably just sing along. We just make music and sing to Drive It Like You Stole It or something like that at the end. I don't know. It's definitely something that's catchy. So
then you get lots of calls from parents, right? Like, what are they singing? Yeah. What is this movie?
I know. Well, it's even that, it's a fairly clean film. Like, it's not something that I'd be worried about when it comes to something like that. Like, I could show that to a group of teenagers and not worry at all about content. There's smoking in it, which I guess is a big deal now.
There's a decent amount of language, right?
Yeah, there's language too. That's true. And that's there. But I also met most teenagers, the ones that I know and have encountered, this will be true to their experience, the kind of conversations that they have in this film. And again, it's 1980s Ireland, and so maybe they say some things that, you know, you can get away with an Irish accent that maybe we can't get away with in America the same way.
Oh,
that's true.
So Josh, I mean, like I said, anything else to add to that? I know you get to spend a lot of time doing family ministry.
Yeah. You know, I think the current youth pastor, Joel, has had it covered pretty well. I mean, I was going to, what?
I was going to say, Joel just doing such a good job, not leaving anything for Josh.
My bad. Josh. I won't say anything else. This is all Josh.
That's fine. You know, I mean, I could just dig deeper into, you know, what he was saying about asking about each individual character. I think that you could easily get kids to talk about, I think you could even get older elementary school students, you know, that maybe might be able to watch and understand something like this, that, but definitely teenagers, you know, you'd definitely be able to, they'd be able to draw out some of the relationships, relational dynamic between Brendan and Connor and Connor and Rafina, you know, like Joel said, kind of that trinity of characters that, really the movie centers around. So, you know, Joel hit it all, which is fine.
Well, okay. Well, let me ask you this, Josh. What is the point of asking a teenager where he connects to it? Because
what's the point of asking a teenager?
Yeah, I mean, like,
what's the point of this podcast?
What is the point? So, well, I mean, so why are we here? We had this conversation recently at a place where I had conversations with people. I'm not going to say where. Yes. So we had this conversation, and it was talking about basically how we do like apologetics and how we evangelize to people and how we talk about worldview. And there was a lot of emphasis put on basically proving other people wrong, but there was very little emphasis put on relationship and the importance that relationship plays in faith or belief. And the thing that I love about what both of you are, or what Joel's saying and what Josh is 100% agreeing with, is that there's this idea that instead of watching a movie like Sing Street and saying, okay, well, we've just watched a film about teenagers, so here's a verse about from Ecclesiastes about being young. So memorize that, and just let that be a lesson, I guess. Instead, you both are advocating for this idea of just seeing what they relate to and asking them those questions. Like, what are we hoping comes of that? You know, I have ideas about this, but like, so Josh, why would you ask a teenager that? What are you hoping that accomplishes?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're trying to connect to the experience. Like, this is going all the way back to what we've already talked about, you know, the idea of creation. And I mean, isn't that kind of the point of the movie, is this idea of creating a piece of art that has something to say, that adds, that takes truth and puts it out there. Now, it might not put it out exactly where we necessarily agree with everything that a movie has to say, or like in the case of the movie, like every bit of music that's written, we don't have to agree with it. But where can we see the God-given value in this? Where can we see how we connect with it? And how does that speak to what God is already doing? Or how does that speak to what maybe the reality that this movie is painting? I think to ask these deeper questions helps us really to be able to engage art in a different way, where, like, you know, we would say at Real World Theology, where entertainment is not mindless, and it's not, we're also not engaging the culture around us, because we're a part of the culture. Sometimes I don't like using the word engage, because to a certain extent we are a part of the culture, like we're already in it. And to be able to understand and to dig deeper into these things helps us to, for a teenager, it's going to help them start to think more critically. It's going to help them to think deeper. It's going to help them to just be able to think when they experience a piece of like a movie, or it might be music, these kind of things. It's going to help teenagers to be able to think better and smarter and more spiritually and more relationally about the entertainment that they take in.
I'm all for that.
Yeah. And I think it's just to building off what Josh said, cause I think that's it. Like, it's helping foster those critical thinking skills, but it's in that it's building, building an awareness. Like, I guess for a teenager, for them to be more aware of what art has to offer, and thinking deeply about that, but also growing an awareness of themselves, aware of how they're responding to that particular piece of art, aware of how it moves them, makes them think, where they're asking that question, like, why did I feel that? Why did it bring up that memory? Why did I notice that scene in particular? Or why did I start crying there? Why can I not stop smiling at this film? Or why did it not connect with me, but it connected with that person over there? What's going on inside of me, or in my particular circumstance right now, that this piece of art didn't resonate with me? Am I paying attention? So those are the kind of things that I think questions like that can help foster. And there's a relational connection too, because there's I'm assuming in that I'm asking that question of somebody in the context of community, and not just engaging with art on an individual level, but recognizing that all culture is inherently relational. We're part of it. And I think Josh, you nailed it. We don't engage with culture. We're already part of the culture. Yeah. We're in the midst of that. And so being in the midst of that, it's asking myself and those around me? How am I more aware of what's actually going on here, both internally and externally, like inside of me and my feelings and my thoughts and memories and all those things, my own identity, but also externally, like what other people are thinking and feeling and what the art itself is contributing to that conversation. Mm.
You know, Joel, it would be really helpful if there'd be someone out there who had written a book about a bunch of movies that you could talk to teenagers about.
Like if they had 50 films that were listed in the back that you could have. If somebody were to write a book like that, it might be called Jesus Goes to the Movies.
Oh, that's so cliche. That they would definitely not do that.
No, they would. And they would have with red theater seats on it and it would be available on Amazon. they could do that. People could find that book.
They could hopefully buy it.
Wow. Amazing. What a world we live in.
I know. That might actually exist. It's not a fantasy. It's a reality.
Oh, man. Well, with that pre-plug, I do want to kind of wrap us up here and say that I feel like we still there are a couple aspects of the film we didn't really talk about Rafina very much or Barry the bully. So I admit that ahead of time, but knowing that we're kind of about out of time, so yeah. If there's anyone who has any questions about what their roles are like in this film or the effect that maybe Connor, our main character, has on those people or vice versa. That's the kind of thing that I would love for you as listeners to bring up in the Real World Theology discussion group on Facebook or, you know, in the comment section where this is posted over at realworldtheology.com. So let us know because I want those conversations to keep going because we got off on a couple little tangents, but I think they were great tangents. And I think they're the kind of things that make this movie worth your time, even though people didn't really see it. But like I always say, as of a couple episodes ago, great conversations happen because we have great guests, and I want you guys to be able to follow the work and the stuff, the blaze the path that the older brothers Josh and Joel have already, kind of blazed for us. So, Josh, where can people find you and what you do around the internet and other places?
Yeah, I'm at Real World Theology. Perhaps you've heard of it. I am on Twitter at Hey It's That Josh. That is my Twitter handle. I am also contractually obligated to mention my affiliation with Letterboxd, the Facebook for movie lovers. It is great. I love seeing what movies people are watching on Letterboxd and also finding out if you liked or hated movies. So you should go there too. I like that Mikey and I finally had somebody admit to breaking down and getting on Letterboxd because of our influence on this show. Yes. So score one for us. Too bad we aren't
non-residuals.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Too bad we actually aren't contractually obligated. But yeah, you know, I'm at Real World Theology. That's pretty much where you'll find all my writings and talkings. I'm writing over there consistently every single week. And have been on the podcast now 2 times in a row. So don't expect that every time. But but I really enjoy it, and that's where you can find me on the internet.
Awesome. Joel, you have any books or anything people can buy?
Yeah, you could definitely buy my book, Jesus Goes to the Movies, the Youth Ministry Film Guide. You can find that on Amazon. You can also find the film reviews and essays that I write at cinemaward.com, CINEMAYWARD, or just find me on Twitter at Joel Mayward, and I'm usually posting things there where I've been writing essays in other places or thoughts on film, and I'm also on Letterboxd, so same thing, Joel Mayward at Letterboxd, and I'd love to connect with you there too. So thank you for having me on. As a guest, this has been an awesome conversation. So yes. I always love being a part of the Real World Theology family, the group, the team, the whatever we are, the band.
I do feel like at times we are like a family. You know, like I said, I feel like we have Connors and Brendans, and hopefully we just don't have any, let me reference, Roberts or Pennies, which is dad and mom that are splitting up. But happy family, I hope, maybe. At least from my perspective, which means that I'm delusional and I have no idea what's going on. If you would like to follow those delusions, you can on Twitter at Fizzification. I have not tweeted very much as of late. I apologize for that and everyone who has followed me. Rate and review the show on iTunes, guys. It really helps us. The more reviews we have, the more written reviews, the more five-star ratings we get, the more people find us, the more people join the conversation, yada, yada, yada. That's awesome. So for those of you who have done it, thank you. For those who haven't, please do. Please consider it. It takes just a couple moments of your time. So thanks. Speaking of thanks, while I'm just doling out thanks like turkey at Thanksgiving, thank you, listeners, for making taking time to make us a part of your week or your drive or however you listen to us, your yard mow, like I listen to most of my podcasts, you know, it does make the chores go by faster. So thank you so much for making us a part of your life. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Wait a minute. You are all bad parents.
I knew it. It's finally been confirmed. You have? Four.
Okay. Okay, cool. Four kids is, yeah, see, that's ambitious. That takes you. You're outgunned. You're outnumbered.
Yep.
Hey, Josh, stop being stupid. Okay.